This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Three Democrats are running for their party's nomination in the 61st Statehouse District. That includes most of the city of Portage, as well as Oshtemo, Prairie Ronde, Texas, and Schoolcraft Townships. Thomas Whitener is one of the Democrats who hopes to win his party's nomination August 7th and challenge Republican Representative Brant Eyden in the fall. Thomas Whitener, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Please introduce yourself to the audience and tell us what you would like to do if you're elected to the State House.
My name's Thomas Whitener, Democrat, lifelong Democrat, running for state representative. I live here in Portage with my wife and have for a number of years. If I'm elected to the State House, I want to take my expertise as a game designer and specifically a systems and balance designer to make sure that the rules that we all have to live by are fair for everyone who lives here in Michigan.
You say as a game designer, that's what you do for a living?
Yes. I've been a game designer for about 10 years now. It's what I trained to do in school. Specifically, my focus is in systems and balance design, like I said, which means that I write sets of rules, and then I make sure that those sets of rules that are large and complex and interactive are fair for everybody who plays the game.
And these are video games that you're
designing? Video games, yes.
I'm sure some people are hearing that and thinking, well, how do you go from game designer to someone who is making policy at the state level? What's the connection? How do those two things mash up?
They're actually very similar. And it's something, how similar they are surprised me a little bit when I started to, after the 2016 election, I think a lot of us decided that we wanted to get more involved. And so I started looking at state law and reading it more and more closely. Most of us don't really take close look at the laws that govern our lives. But when you do, when you have the background that I do, you start to pull out how these systems are built, how they interact with each other, and how they all work toward goals. And that's exactly what we do in games. But we write for different purposes in games. You're not trying to make people's lives better. You're trying to make someone have a good time. But as long as you have a set goal, you can design systems toward it. And the experience carries over quite well, I think.
Are there particular issues that you can identify where you say, well, my experience as a game designer is going to lead me to be able to represent my constituents better?
Yes. The one that comes to mind most easily is education and the way our education system is funded specifically. Education is funded, and this is a simplification because it's a very complex system, but by and large, from the state side of things, education is funded based on per student enrolled. So you have students who are enrolled in the school, and that number leads to a calculation based on the area, but leads to a calculation of how much money the school gets. Well, what ends up happening is you achieve something called a positive feedback loop. It's what we call it in games, where schools that have high enrollment do well because they get lots of money and they can fund the programs they want. They can pay their teachers well. They can pay for supplies. They can pay for upkeep. But if a for-profit charter school pops up in the area, or people are pulling their kids out of school for some reason, then the funding for that school starts to drop. And it pushes a positive feedback loop in and of itself pushes toward the extremes. So people who are doing well do better, and people who aren't doing well do worse. I look at this and I say, well, the system is broken. The way that we're funding is broken. We need to move toward a negative feedback loop, which sounds bad, but all it really means is that it allows people who are doing well to continue doing well at the level that they are, or schools that are doing well to continue to doing well, and then the schools that are not doing as well to move toward that median level to get them back up to an acceptable point. And the way you do that is, instead of funding per student enrolled, you fund based on the possible enrollment. So that if you pull students out of a school, you're not actually changing its funding level. You're keeping the same amount of money from the state in the school, which means that you have a higher average spend per student, which allows higher achievement, or at least higher investment and higher possible achievement.
So, if you're going to allow schools to be funded, as you say, at the highest possible enrollment, and yet you're still going to ensure that the students who leave that school are properly educated wherever else they go, does that mean that the state has to put more overall money into education?
No, I think that the voucher system, the system of shifting state funds, our tax dollars, away from the public schools that they were intended, that at least in my estimation, they should be funding, toward these for-profit charter schools and the schools that the vouchers are going toward, that system needs to be discontinued or at least severely curtailed so that the overall investment in the system can stay the same. We're not having to collect more and spend more to put money in the pocket of the owners of these for-profit schools. The for-profit schools statistically haven't performed better, and in some cases are performing worse than their public school equivalents in the same areas. The data has shown us that, and I don't know why we would fund a less effective system with our tax dollars when we have a public education system that has been in place. I'd rather fix the systems that we built previously than throw them out and try something completely new and untested.
Just want to note on the term voucher, because some people's ears are going to perk up because mm-hmm. they associate that with private schools, which is actually banned in the Michigan Constitution,
right,
or for parochial schools. What you're talking about is when the per student state grant follows a student from that public school to the charter school.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Sorry, that is called voucher systems, and in other systems that I've been looking at, and yeah, there are two things that make good game designers, and the first is that you can't let a problem sit in front of you and not try to solve it, and the second is you have to be a sponge and just read and learn everything you can get your hands on. I've been reading state law in other states, specifically Massachusetts and Colorado and North Carolina and others, and trying to find solutions that have been tested in other systems as well, and seeing how we can apply those to Michigan.
So when it comes to charter schools, are you saying that you don't think the state should have charter schools at all, or is there a different way that they should be funded?
I mean, the public school system isn't going to work for every child, isn't going to work for every family. I'm willing to admit that, and happy for there to be other options in the private sector that explore the niches that need to exist to serve those students. I think that's important, and I think that's a good thing. But I don't think those are things that should be funded by the state, by our tax dollars. If someone wants to run a for-profit company, even if they're in the education sector, then we need to ensure that the education provided is up to the level that we require for our students here in Michigan. But we also need to make sure that the public schools that everyone has access to, that lift us as a society and build our communities, those need to be funded properly. And that needs to be what our tax dollars go to.
So if someone wants to go to a charter school, you're saying they should pay for that themselves?
Yes.
You are the first candidate who has been in here since the situation in Parchment became known regarding PFAS in the water.
Yeah.
What's the state's responsibility and role here, not just for Parchment, but for communities throughout Michigan?
So the emergency response and the speed with which the local community and the state has tackled this, as soon as it became a big story, has been impressive. It's good to see the response be as quick, but I think it was 7 years ago the MDEQ received the warning about PFAS and the fact that there was contamination and we needed to expect that. We needed to be looking out for it, and we haven't been looking out for it well enough. The fact that the Parchment water crisis was such a surprise is part of the problem. I look at everything like system, as a series of systems. We need to have a system in place that takes this information when we get, warnings from scientists and processes it and then puts into place detection schemes so that we can find these issues. There's all sorts of things that could have been done to make sure that we were watching out for this. But the systematic defunding of the Department of Environmental Quality has really put a hamper on our ability to expect these crises and to stop being reactive to them and start being proactive. I don't want us to only respond to these crises once they've started causing harm. We need to be in the business of preventing harm.
And how does a state representative address that in particular?
Well, through the allocation of resources to our regulatory and our environmental quality agencies. If we focus more and give them the resources they need, as well as the oversight and the directives, which that it would have to be done in cooperation with the governor's office and, with cooperation with of the offices themselves, the departments themselves. But realigning our focus on prevention instead of response and giving them the funds and giving them the resources that they need to enact that, I think is something that a state legislator and the state legislature as a whole is going to be able to do.
Do you think the state also needs to put more money into testing to find out if these chemicals are in other communities in the state? Portage just said that they tested theirs. They found some above detectable limits, mm-hmm. but none that reached the level of the health advisory limits. Should the state be...
They don't reach the level of the current health advisory limits.
Okay, correct.
There's a study and a recommendation that's coming through the federal system that has been stopped by the Trump White House that advises the upper limit to be brought down to 12 parts per trillion, and Portage just tested one of their systems. And I'm laughing because I live in Portage, and there's only two options, laugh and cry, and I choose the laugh usually.
But two of them that came back would be above that 12 parts
above
per trillion.
Would be above that level, and that's scary for someone who lives there and has been drinking that water, and has my wife been drinking that water, and yeah.
In any event, should the state be putting more money into testing, and should they be putting more money into some sort of means of addressing the issue if it comes back, that those tests do come back at a level, whatever it may be said at that time, that's above the health advisory level?
I think so. I think clean water and clean air is a absolutely critical part of the state's responsibility, ensuring that when a citizen or a resident turns on their tap, that they can trust what comes out of it. When they step outside and they take a deep breath, that Michigan air is as clean as we all expect it to be. I think that's part of what the state should ensure, and I think we should devote the necessary resources to ensure that.
On another environmental issue, do you think that Line 5 should be shut down in the Straits of Mackinac?
I think Line 5 should be shut down, but I think we need to do it in a way that transitions the workers that earn their livelihoods from these pipelines. I think oil and gas infrastructure in Michigan, the aging oil and gas infrastructure that we have, should be phased out and we should move toward renewable energy. But we need to do it in a sustainable way so that we're not impacting people's livelihoods. It's a complex question. The environmentalist in me wants to say, shut it down now, cap the wells and put up solar panels everywhere. But I understand that that's not perfectly feasible. We should start moving toward it, though. It's, the aging oil and gas infrastructure, Line 5 is the most obvious example, but it's failed before. The Kalamazoo River oil spill is still being cleaned up in part, and we've experienced what happens when these things break down, and it's only a matter of time. And Line 5 breaking in the Straits of Mackinac would be an absolute disaster, not just ecologically, not just environmentally, but economically. Tourism here in Michigan is a massive industry. The ability for people to go and enjoy their Great Lakes is critical to large swaths of our economy. And, you know, covering it in oil, I can't see as a boon to that sector.
Would you want to put a timeline on it? Would you want to say Line 5 should be shut down as of X date?
I think as long as I'm allowed to revise X date when I have more information, yes. But I don't have the information available to me right now to put a date on it. But I think we should start planning for it. You can't hit a target if you don't plan to hit it. So yeah, absolutely. Let's put a date on it. Let's put a date on it that we talk with industry, we talk with the Plumbers and Pipefitters Union, we talk with the people who this is going to affect, and then we put a plan in place to take care of it. We build a system, and then we let the system take care of it.
What would you want to do to make Michigan's roads more drivable?
Michigan has a difficult time with building roads because of the high water table. Our lakes are beautiful. It's fantastic, but it does make it difficult when you have so much water in the soil. You've got a very harsh climate, and the things that we have to do to our roads to keep them safe in the winter tends toward destroying them. We need better ways of constructing roads, and we need a longer term look. Instead of patching small areas of roads, we need to invest in larger projects that will pay dividends going into the future. I think there are lots of opportunities to fund research into more advanced road materials. We have some of the best universities in the world here in Michigan, and we can use those resources that would not only help Michigan build roads that last in adverse conditions and adverse climates when they're coated with salt, when they're scraped constantly, but also give opportunities to engineering students and civil engineering students to, you know, advance their careers and do the research that really will, you know, put them ahead and give us the talent base we need moving into the future to continue being the powerhouse state that we always have been.
Recently did an interview with a Republican running for state senate, another district outside of here, who raised a similar concern that you have, that the Michigan is not keeping up with the technology that might allow us to build better roads that could last longer. I'll ask you the same question I asked him. Does that mean that Michigan, though, will have to put some more money up front in order to perhaps find the best practices? Perhaps these things don't cost the same price that we're paying right now to do what we're doing. They may cost a little more to do them, at least in the short term.
I'm a fan of the phrase that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Yes, up front, it might cost a little more. We already pay the fourth highest gas tax in the nation. We already pay more for our roads than most states. I think we should have at least the fourth best roads if we're paying the fourth highest gas tax.
Does that mean, though, we might have to find more money from somewhere?
Yeah.
In order to do it?
It might. I'm not sure how the breakdown right now exactly looks. But if we have to find that money, if we have to find a way to get our roads into shape, it's something that's critical to individual constituents. You pay an extra gas tax on top of it, essentially, every time you have to repair a wheel or fix a flat. That's money out of the pockets of everyday people. And then also it affects the ability of our businesses to move goods to market, and that's a drain on the economy in general. So yes, it might cost a little bit more up front, but I think that the benefits long term will more than make up for the costs if we do the investment and we do it right.
Would you be willing to go to your constituents and tell them they have to pay higher taxes and or fees for that?
I'd be willing to have that conversation.
What would you like to do to reduce the rate of auto insurance in Michigan?
I think the first thing that we need to do is get more transparency in the Catastrophic Claims Administration or agency that agency, administration? I'm not sure.
Administration, I believe, is correct.
So many acronyms to learn
MCCA,
when you're rowing
right.
for all of this. But the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association is, right now it's essentially a black box. We don't get to find out why the numbers that they set are the numbers that they set. We don't get to have any input on it. I think having some citizen input on that, having some legislative oversight, having some transparency, so we at least know why they're claiming that we need to pay an extra $192 this year as opposed to 100 and whatever, 42, 72 last year. We need to find out, okay, why is it increasing faster than the rates of other states? Why is, why do we pay so much? Once we find out why, then we can take steps to address it. But I think the transparency needs to exist first.
Are you open to the idea that perhaps Michigan cannot continue its practice of providing lifetime coverage to people who suffer serious injuries in catastrophic auto accidents?
I don't think I have enough data to make that decision. I think it's a great thing that we do provide the unlimited catastrophic insurance. That makes a huge difference in the lives of people who have suffered these accidents or been affected by these things. The costs that can accrue when someone is in the hospital just for a short time are staggering. And for someone who's dealing with a continuing chronic or issue due to a catastrophic accident, that insurance can be the difference between living a life that of dignity or being shoved into poverty through no fault of your own. I think that if we are going to have to discontinue it, we need to make absolutely sure that there's no other way around it.
What changes, if any, would you favor to Michigan's laws on guns?
So I grew up in North Carolina, running around the woods of North and South Carolina with my grandfather. I've been a hunter my entire life. I've been a competitive shooter for a long time. And I'm a responsible gun owner. Guns are powerful tools. The Second Amendment is very important to a lot of people, especially here in Michigan with all of our wild spaces and all of the hunting and the sportsmen in this state. But guns are tools, and they have very specific purposes, and different ones, just like a set of chisels, different guns have different purposes. I think we need to increase regulation on the types of firearms that are available for sale to specific people. I think we need to approve the so-called red flag laws to allow the state or the government to come in dangerous situations and remove guns, remove things that could make a dangerous situation worse. I think we need a universal background, a universal instant background check system. I think we need to raise the purchasing age of all firearms to 21 years of age. These are small steps, right, that get toward a situation where we know who has firearms. We know that the people who are buying firearms are the type of people who should have access to them, and that we're not unintentionally or intentionally creating dangerous situations and making them worse. The gun show loophole is another area that we should close. It's not something that ever should have existed, in my estimation. And it's a hole in the rules. And as a game designer, I can't look at a hole in a set of rules and not want to patch it. So that's where I come from there.
Michigan voters will decide in November whether or not to legalize marijuana for recreational purposes. Do you believe that they should approve that ballot proposal?
I believe that they should. I'm not a marijuana user. I have in the past. I went to college. But it's more of an issue of civil rights to me. In general, prohibitions, whenever they've existed, have been used to further oppress already oppressed people. And I'm of the opinion that those type of prohibitions that don't have a basis in public health, because marijuana isn't a Schedule I drug, it doesn't fit the definition. It has medical uses. It's not as inherently dangerous even as alcohol. Prohibitions that exist, like marijuana, typically are just used as a club to keep down people who are already put down. And that's not the type of thing that we need to have here in Michigan. It'll also open up a lot of new revenue streams. We've seen that in evidence in Colorado. It doesn't, at least the preliminary data coming out of the states that have gone for, the states and municipalities that have gone for legalization, doesn't show an increased usage in the drug by children or young adults. It doesn't tend to show vehicle accidents rising by a statistically significant amount. It doesn't lead to an increase in other harder drug use. And so the data tends to point toward it being a good thing, something that can get a lot of revenue for the state, something that can open up new business opportunities in our communities, while at the same time not having a lot of the boogeyman negative effects that a lot of the detractors of these types of proposals have suggested would come to pass.
Do you favor the redistricting proposal, voters, not politicians, which we, at this point, is subject to a court fight, so we're not sure it's going to be on the ballot. But assuming it is, do you think voters should approve that?
I think they should. I think, first, it should be on the ballot. And second, that voters should approve it. The Voters Not Politicians initiative is one of the most elegant pieces of game design I've ever seen in my life. It absolutely takes a very, very difficult situation of incentives and gamesmanship and narrows it down and effectively makes the system ungameable, which is impressive. I was telling you before we started, my grandfather, who was United States House of Representatives for 23 years in North Carolina, was gerrymandered out of his seat by his own party. And this was done to pick up two seats somewhere else. He loved his job, and he was good at it. But it was just part of the game. And I don't think that should be part of the game. I don't think that a party should be able to pick the voters that they want. I think we voters live here. We should get to pick our representatives.
Can you really make this system ungameable? I've seen lots of things where people have put in reforms and then political actors have figured ways around it. I mean, can you really make something like redistricting ungameable?
It's an arms race, and it always has been, and it always will be. Any designer or any developer who's ever released a game to millions of people know that as soon as you put a set of rules in front of people, they will try to break them, and they will succeed. They will find the issues. But that's why we patch. That's why we edit laws. That's why we amend things. It's why we want to have the ability to amend things in the future. Because when you find an exploit, you fix it. It's simple, and it's ingrained as a designer in my sensibilities. When you find a hole, you patch it. When you find an exploit, you fix it. It prevents the collapse of the entire system, which is critical, especially in something as important as government.
Lots of Democrats are hoping for a big year in 2018.
I'm one of them.
And they are hoping that perhaps Democrats can take control of the state house. I've seen one analysis that said that this district would be an important one for Democrats to pick up if they are going to have control of the state house. Of course, 61st state house district's been Republican forever. If you're talking to Democratic voters, how do you tell them that Thomas Whitener's the guy who can get there in November and can change the outcome?
People talk a lot about a blue wave. And there is definitely a level of energy, a level of enthusiasm, and a level of focus from the Democratic Party that I haven't seen at least since 2008. But the blue wave doesn't happen as some sort of mystical force that sweeps in from the edges of the universe to change everyone and make everybody vote. It happens because you've got candidates out there who are wearing the soles off of their shoes, knocking on doors and getting voters excited and getting people out there. You've got voters who are reading the news and they're upset or they're energized or they have a candidate that they believe in and they want to get out there and they want to vote. The blue wave isn't an external happening. The blue wave is us, and it happens because of hard work. I've been working hard for the last, goodness, it's been about 6 months now, contacting voters, getting in touch with community leaders, speaking at events, knocking on people's doors, and wearing the soles off of my shoes, trying to get in contact with everyone I can, trying to build that blue wave. And that's what it's going to take. It's going to take work. And I've never been afraid to work hard in the past, and I'll never be afraid to work hard in the future. And that's what you can count on if you elect me to be your representative.
Thomas Whitener is one of three Democrats running for state house in the 61st district. That includes most of the city of Portage, as well as Oshtemo, Prairie Ronde, Texas, and Schoolcraft townships. Thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
The winner of the August primary will challenge Republican Representative Brant Eyden in the fall. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.